This is Virginally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and we're going to find out next about a little history, but first some facts to pass along about the upcoming 104th running of what has been called for a long, long time the greatest spectacle in racing. And we don't care what these other states have to say, it still is the greatest spectacle in racing. We're, of course, referring to the Indianapolis 500-mile race. The running for this year is scheduled, and as of 5 seconds ago, it's still the same. It's Sunday, August 23rd at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway in the Speedway, Indiana. And the only difference we're going to see is the size of crowds. They're only allowing for 25% capacity because of the impact of the coronavirus pandemic. Face coverings will be required from everybody who shows up at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and a lot of other precautions are being taken to make sure that people are safe as possible when the Indianapolis Motor Speedway opens up for the race itself on race day. But the pandemic notwithstanding, there have been delays and there have been cancellations in the past of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And who better to ask about that but the historian for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, Donald Davidson. He is with us from his home. I don't know, David, if you live in Speedway or not, or if you just live in Indy. But
I do live in Speedway.
Well, that's what I thought. I've asked you that question, I think, a long time ago, and you told me Speedway, but I wasn't sure. I couldn't recall.
A lot of people think that that's a joke, but it's actually a town.
Oh, yeah.
When the track was built, it was farmland, but a community built up around the track. And they had a development, which they called Speedway City, which was just a name that they gave the development. But and it wasn't a city. But in 1926, it was incorporated as a town. Mm-hmm. And it continues to operate that way. And this is more than you wanted. But there's no mayor of Speedway, but they have a town board.
No, that's right.
And they have their own police department, own fire station, own school system, and own water department, and we're sort of landlocked now, but I do live in Speedway, Indiana.
And there are some nice houses in Speedway, by the way, too. We should just say that it's not all the Speedway City, as which I know it used to be called a long time ago, but it is a town, and it is a very nice community, and it's all built up now. They've really, really gone crazy in trying to build up and prepare for expansion in Speedway, I understand, over the last decade, and I'm probably longer than that, right?
Yes, it's probably, that's a good question. It's at least 10 years, but
yeah.
Anyway, there's the Speedway Redevelopment Committee, and the Main Street, which is just to the southwest of the track property, is Main Street of Speedway,
mm-hmm.
And that's been there for, 100 and something years. And so, yes, there's been a great deal of redevelopment up and down there for the last 6, 7, 8 years. It's
now,
really something now.
I don't recall if they did. They change the name of 16th Street, basically in Indianapolis, when it comes out, when you get to the track, and then Georgetown Road comes in there at an angle. That makes up the other side of the property there where the Indianapolis Motor Speedway is.
Georgetown Road runs north and south,
yeah.
Except that you can't get there now because of the roundabout. And that's Georgetown Road. 16th Street has been several different things over the years, but I think it became 16th Street, in the late 20s probably. But
yeah.
Anyway, that's another long story.
Well, I suppose it's probably good to have given this little traffic report, but folks that have not been down, if they do make it down to the Speedway for the race, and they will probably need to know that there's a roundabout there. Things have changed in around the track over the years here to be aware of that. But most importantly, the changes that have come about because of the fact that, among, I guess, other things, Mother Nature has had something to say about the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, about the race itself that's held during the summer months. And David, I understand, if I'm not mistaken, that there are, 6 times that there have actually been cancellations of the race?
That was for the two world wars. The first 500 was May the 30th of 1911, which is the old Memorial Day. And in 1917 and 1918, they suspended. There was no race because of America's involvement in World War I. And then 42 through 45... because of America's involvement in World War II. But other than that, there's been an Indianapolis 500 every year. As far as the date is concerned, it used to be on May the 30th, regardless of the day of the week on which it fell, except for Sunday, in which case it would go to Monday, May the 31st. So the 500 for the first half century or more was always on Tuesday or Friday or Thursday or whenever the 30th fell, except, as I say, when it was Sunday, then it would go to Monday, May 31st. In 1971, Congress changed the recognition of Memorial Day to the last Monday in the month, and the track did two or three different things. They ran it on Saturday, and then a couple of other things happened. Anyway, in 1973, they had gone to Monday. Actually, the story is the 500 Festival Committee has this huge parade, which used to be the evening before the race.
Mm-hmm.
And they had an opportunity to put it on TV live, but the requirement was that it would be Saturday afternoon. And so the 500 in 1973 was moved to Monday. And unfortunately, weather and some other problems interfered. It pushed it into a third day. And so they thought, well, we gave up Saturday, and we don't want to try Monday again. So they went to all of the local religious organizations, and they came back with an understanding that in 1974, the 500 would finally be held on Sunday. And it's been that way ever since. The date keeps changing. And to try and pull this to a neat little bow around the conclusion, there's been several weather delays. They've been postponed and had to move and push a day or two. But the latest that has ever gone was May the 31st. We have never, ever run on June the 1st. So this year, it's a first.
Mm-hmm.
We're running in August, as far as we know.
Okay. Now, when we talk about the delays, we talk in this case here about, I guess, about delays, first off, because of the wars, both World War I and World War II. One of the things that maybe people are aware of, and maybe not, is the creation of the track itself and what kind of uses the track had during the wars.
During the war, well, it was built originally not as a racetrack to entertain fans, but as a proving ground for the automobile industry, and that that the automobile races were supposed to be for stripped-down passenger cars so that the manufacturers could show the public how good their vehicles were. It's like a form of testing. Well, anyway, during World War One, when they shut down, the infield was used. There was an aviation depot.
Mm-hmm.
There were three battalions just down the street, just three, four blocks down on Main Street, and they used the infield of the Indianapolis Speedway as an aviation. It was a refueling depot. There was one route was Dayton, Ohio, from what eventually became Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, except that that was still a few decades away, and Champaign-Urbana, and they would stop in the infield at the track to refuel. They also tested several experimental aircraft out of there, and as I say, there were three maintenance battalions. Their headquarters was the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. So that ended when the race started again in 1919. All of that was done. And then in 1942, late 41, early 42, when they shut down for World War II, by this time, the track was owned, or the titular head was the famed Captain Eddie Rickenbacker from World War One Flying Ace, who had, in fact, been a driver in the 500 before the war. Well, anyway, he offered it to the government, and they came and looked, and it was not suitable for World War II aircraft, and so the track was shut down, and other than for the beautiful golf course they had there, it was just allowed to overgrow terribly for four and a half years, and then after the war, then Rickenbacker sold it, and they were up and running again by 1946. So, mm-hmm. Aviation depot on the infield in World War One, just sat there and turned into a jungle.
And then, of course, at that point, like you say, at the end of World War II is when Captain Rickenbacker sold the property to Tony Holman. And that's where the Holman family has come into play ever since then. And
However, they sold it. It transferred the early January to a new group that Roger Penske set up, Penske Entertainment. And so the Holman George family had it from November of 1945 until January of 2020. And now it has just gone into its fourth ownership under the direction of Roger Penske.
Mm-hmm. Now, Donald, we've talked here about the changes that happened in the Indianapolis Motor Speedway itself here after its creation in the early part of the 20th century and making it through the midway through the 20th century, and then when races resumed after World War II. We also know that because of the time that it has always run in the summer months, the weatherman doesn't always cooperate. And I know that there have been a lot of delays, although I'm sure there probably haven't been as many delays that have caused any real cancellation, but there have been weather-related delays all through the history of the race. And
oh, yes. I mean, even 1915 was postponed a couple of days, but they had several where they either started and then they had to stop and then continue on if less than 50% had been completed, and then other times when it rained on race day and then they had to go to a second or a third day. And there's been several examples of that. They've had some rain shorten races. I would have to count them up now. It was like five or six did not go the distance.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have to count them up. But for whenever they had to push into a second, third day, or even go to the following Saturday, as they did in 1986.
Mm-hmm.
It has never gone beyond May the 31st. We always had a winner by May the 31st, so this is definitely new territory.
Now, Donald, have there been any cases where there have been relatively lengthy delays because of tragedy, because of accidents and deaths that have happened at the Speedway?
Both. I mean, I don't enjoy talking about that.
Yeah.
But normally, an accident would never push. I mean, there's been stoppages because of accidents, but It was never postponed. No, weather normally was the reason why they would have to go to a second day or third.
Mm-hmm. I know it's hard to believe here because of what we've been going through here lately, that we've had all these major changes in the race itself. And in your recollection, besides the cancellation of races because of wars, two world wars in this case, that have come about, and the delays that have happened as well, have we found any possibility that maybe it might have discouraged fans from showing up? Maybe because especially if they were aware, if the publicity got out, the fact that they had to delay the race because of the weather and like, did it ever cut back on the attendance that you're aware of?
No, in fact, it's amazing because there's been some years where, and I don't enjoy talking about this very much because I went through a lot of them myself, but there were years when you went home and you just wanted to forget that it happened, and a lot of people said, I don't know if I'm going to go back, and then, the days, weeks pass, and the next thing they know, they're renewing their tickets to come back again.
Well, that shows how dedicated the racing fans are, and that's why we keep calling it, as rightfully so, is the greatest spectacle in racing. And regardless of what the folks in NASCAR have to say, it still is the greatest spectacle in racing. its history is on its side, to be sure. And Donald, thank you very much for spending time with us, bringing us up to date on some of the reasons that there have been delays at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. In this case, because of the weather, and because of this case of warfare, to be sure. And we hope that we have better times ahead, and we have to talk in more detail about the greatest spectacle in racing again.
Well, hopefully next. next year, it's at the end of May.
That's right. Get it back in the early summer where it's supposed to be sure.
Right.
Donald Davidson is the historian for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and we thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Chris.
We've just learned from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and from the Governor Holcomb's office that this year's Indianapolis 500-mile race will be run, but without spectators. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
Both he and my mother really, they put a spirit of justice in me. And one of the things that I remember that has stuck with me today, but I kind of processed it differently as a child. But I remember one day, and I was probably about 7 years old, and we were out at what was then Tri-City Shopping Center on Fifth Avenue. We left out of a store, and we were going, we got in the car. And when we got in the car, my mother said to my dad, "Did you see that that little boy didn't have any shoes on?" And he said, "Yeah, I did." And so she said, "Well, why didn't we take him in there to get shoes?" And he said, "I don't know." So they turned the car around to go back to find the little boy, and he was gone. And they agonized over that. Why did we do that? Why didn't we stop? We could have taken him in the store. So in my mind, I processed, anytime you see someone who doesn't have shoes, it's your responsibility to try to get the shoes for them. And that's what I processed in a seven-year-old mind. That kind of stuck with me, that you're supposed to help people that are unable to help themselves. And that's the kind of mindset that went on in my family. I think part of it came from his background because he grew up in Rock Island, Illinois, one of the quiet cities. My mother grew up in Evanston. When he was in high school, and he said this was really a mess for him, but he lettered in all sports. He was really good in track, but he played basketball, football. And he was very strong academically, to the point where they gave him a standardized test with everyone. He scored so high, they made him come back and take the test in front of the superintendent, the principal, the teachers. They all sat there and watched him retake the test, and he scored higher. So he was actually named his class president his senior year, which he got a little letter congratulating the colored boy, you know. And so he said whenever someone black came into town that was like entertainer or whatever, they would literally come get him out of class and take him to welcome the person to town. And he said that was so embarrassing for me. I felt like there's some adult that could do this. But they did that. And then as soon as he graduated from high school, he was drafted and became a Tuskegee Airman. And then from there, he had several college scholarships, but he chose to go to Northwestern. So when he finished at Northwestern, he came back to Rock Island to teach, and they wouldn't let him. And they said, well, one of the guys said, "Well, Jim, look, let us give you another job, and so they can kind of get used to looking at you, and then maybe we can move you into a teaching position." And so he sued them, but of course he didn't win. This was 1950, and he didn't win. But in the meantime, another teacher there that had taught him said, "Look, I have a friend in Gary, Indiana, and they're hiring teachers. I'm sure I could help you get on there." And he did. And in retrospect, he says the best thing that happened to him, because he taught at Roosevelt for many years. And then when Mayor Hatcher won, he first got a job with their Model Cities program. And he left for a time and got a job with a company, the Jacobs Company, that set up Model Cities programs for cities that got the grants. And so he traveled and set them up. And then he came back and became Mayor Hatcher's special assistant. And then they created the deputy mayor in the state legislature. They made that position, and he became the deputy mayor. And after leaving there, he went and became the general manager for the bus company. All this time, he was teaching at IUN, too. His passion was always, number one, it was teaching, but also that justice part was in him. And he passed that on to me. And on the other side, he met my mom because she lived in Evanston. He went to Northwestern. But her family had been involved in desegregating the educational system in Evanston as well. So it's just in my blood.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Meals on Wheels in Northwest Indiana is open for business despite the pandemic. In fact, they're even busier than ever, it seems, because of the fact that many people in Northwest Indiana, seniors and others that can't handle, for some reason, take care of themselves for a meal, they need the extra help. And that is what the folks at Meals on Wheels are all about, and helping Northwest Indiana residents out. With us to talk about the organization and how it's dealing with the pandemic, we have the executive director of Meals on Wheels of Northwest Indiana, Sandra Noe, with us, as well as Rachel Hurst. She's the director of development for Meals on Wheels. And ladies, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome. Well, let's ask first, Sandra, if you will, let people know, if they're not familiar with Meals on Wheels, what Meals on Wheels is all about, and about the importance of dealing with problems of food insecurity, which this does really come down to for many people during the pandemic.
Certainly, Meals on Wheels of Northwest Indiana has been serving nutritional meals to our community since 1977. And so you can imagine over those years, we've had quite some few changes. Our mission is to deliver nutritious meals to those in need. And what I'd love your listeners to know is that all of us have a different reason why we might need help getting a good nutritious meal in our homes. Mm-hmm. It might be because we're suffering from a chronic disease like diabetes or COPD. It might be because we can no longer walk, or we just can't get to the grocery store and figure out how to manage a diabetic meal. Or it might just be that we had surgery, or you know, my husband was chopping down a tree and he fell and hurt his back and we need some help. So there's as many reasons out there for needing services as there are people, and we like to try to make that happen.
When somebody is requesting some help because of not being able to either prepare a meal or to have a meal taken care of to them, how do they make arrangements? And in turn, what is the mechanism back at the headquarters, so to speak, for Meals on Wheels to be able to get those meals out to people that need them?
So a person would simply call us at 219-756-3663 or 756-FOOD, whichever is easier to remember, mm-hmm. and call and talk to our staff and let us know what their needs are. We take a registration over the phone, and it typically takes us 24 to 48 hours to get that started. We really try to meet the needs of the individual in understanding what their health condition might be, their dietary needs are, so that we serve therapeutic meals, diabetic meals, renal meals, no vitamin K, as well as a heart-healthy traditional meal.
Mm-hmm.
So we take that information over the phone, and within 24 to 48 hours, our volunteers are bringing a meal to your door Monday through Friday.
Wow. That's quite a setup that you have to have there, because that basically involves not only preparing meals and getting them packaged properly, getting the right kind, as you say, the right kind of meals for whoever is expected to get whatever it is, whether it's diabetic or therapeutic or, you know, special needs of any kind, and then it has to get delivered. So you have folks in the kitchen and you have folks on the road, though, don't you?
Right. We have a professional staff in the kitchen because we do serve people who have health compromised systems.
Mm-hmm.
So we like to make sure that we are following all the safety standards to do a good job at getting a meal to your door. But we also use about 650 volunteers. They are an incredible piece of what makes our mission of Meals on Wheels actually happen. So while we feel that delivering meals is an important piece of what we do, our volunteer system is what really makes that happen.
Do you find that having people who maybe have helped out in hospitals, kitchens in the past, or other institutions, they help work as professionals in getting those meals together for you?
We often hire professional kitchen staff in our facility here, from mm-hmm. who have worked in other kitchens, whether it be someone who has worked in one of the kitchens at the casinos or the hospitals or the schools. about the passion for making sure your neighbor has a good meal.
So they basically are very familiar with the situation, the special situation, in being able to put together a number of meals together. It's more than just serving up a meal just to a family of four, as you might say. It's a lot more involved than that, to be sure. Rachel, being the development or director of development, for Meals on Wheels, what's your official role? And during the pandemic, what have you had to kind of take on as extra duties?
Well, during the pandemic, everybody has really pitched in to do what's needed because our priority is to make sure that we meet our mission and we are there without fail for the people who are depending on us. So the whole team here has been incredible, and we've seen an increase in the number of new volunteers coming, stepping up during this time. Even some people who maybe have more flexible time now due to working from home. So it's been pretty great. So we've also seen so many people coming to support the organization financially, whether that is our corporate partners, small businesses throughout the area, individual donors. Our need has grown during this pandemic. At different points, we've been up. We've seen anywhere from a 25% increase overnight to up to a 400% increase in requests for service.
Oh, my goodness.
And so we have stepped up to meet that need. We've also partnered to meet some unusual needs that emerged during COVID, like bringing meals to people recently discharged from the hospital who have nowhere to go because they're homeless, and making sure that they have healthy meals and can recover from their treatment. So my job here is just to help the community invest in Meals on Wheels and feel great about doing that. So if people are interested in giving a gift to Meals on Wheels, learning more, they can visit our website, which is MOWNWI, like Meals on Wheels, NorthwestIndiana.org. And there's lots of opportunities there to give to our pandemic relief fund, or to get involved in some of our upcoming events that have some social distancing measures in place but are still taking place to increase awareness and build support for meals.
Mm-hmm. Now, in having to deal with the pandemic, obviously you have to take special precaution, more than just the usual precautions that you normally take in preparing meals for people that go out from the building and off to the individual homes, wherever they may happen to be here in the region. But obviously it's been an extra expense to have to keep things up as far as special sanitation and special procedures. What have you had to do aside from the usual things that you do in food preparation and delivery?
Well, of course, we took what we have a reputation for doing very well, keeping an extraordinarily clean kitchen here at Meals on Wheels and having the right protocols in place. But with COVID, of course, we had to up that, like the hospitals and the doctor's offices and even the restaurants, in that constant washing of hands, wearing gloves, everyone is masked. Our entire facility is sanitized every evening when we leave. So we've had some of those protocols. What we've also put into place is a no-touch delivery system, and I'd love for your listeners to hear that we are coming to the door, we are placing the food on the door handle, calling the recipient of that meal and letting them know they're there. And that does two things for us. It's an ability to bring them a meal without compromising their situation, but also we have an opportunity to speak to them and make sure everything's going well. Because besides bringing a meal, Meals on Wheels also brings a reassurance to that person that we serve and to their family that if something's amiss, if there's a change in condition in that home, we know about it, and we can be a support system for the family and for the individual. So we've been able to keep that up through our no-touch delivery as well as through a phone pal system that we instituted while we're not actually able to spend those 5 minutes talking to a client when we make a delivery. We're doing that on the phone now. Meals on Wheels is so much more than a meal. It really is a relief from the isolation that all of us are feeling and raises our stress levels tremendously. Our people who are not able to get out of their home, it's been all the harder for them.
Well, certainly something that's very important, and it's always important because of the general service, but in the times of pandemic that we're facing right now, it's even more important to be sure. Once again, if anyone's interested in knowing more about Meals on Wheels, would like to be able to help out financially or even be a volunteer, how do you be able to do so?
By calling us at 219-756-3663. There's so many ways that you can help your community by become involved at Meals on Wheels. Just give us a call. As Rachel mentioned earlier, on August 23rd, we're having our Spinning Spokes Feeding Folks, a virtual ride that you can go out on and help to support us. And as well, we're having an annual charity car and bike show on August 29th at Pete & Sons in Crown Point. Great way that one of our businesses in Northwest Indiana is supporting Meals on Wheels.
Well, there are two great opportunities to take advantage of being involved with Meals on Wheels and helping Meals on Wheels out, to be sure. And Sandra and Rachel, thank you very much for being with us to talk about it today.
Thank you. Thanks, Chris. Stay well.
Thank you. I will do my best on that. Sandra Noe is the executive director, and Rachel Hurst is the director of development. They're both with Meals on Wheels of Northwest Indiana. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. And on tomorrow's program, we'll get caught up on how Indiana politics is faring these days, in particular with another election ahead. We've gotten the primary election that was late in coming out of the way. Now it's time to look to the general election in November, and we'll talk with Indiana political analyst Andy Downs about that on tomorrow's program. We hope you can join us.